Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I'd like to start with a review from the last show where we left off, setting the debt trap, emerging markets for petrodollar loans. When the price of oil quadrupled in the 1970s, OPEC countries were suddenly flooded with U.S. currency, and these petrodollars were usually deposited in London and New York banks, which recycled them as low-interest loans to third-world countries that were desperate to borrow dollars to finance their oil imports. Like other loans made by commercial banks, these loans did not actually consist of money deposited by their clients. The deposits merely served as reserves for loans created by the multiplier effect out of thin air. Through the magic of the fractional reserve lending, dollars belonging to the Arab sheikhs were multiplied many times over as accounting entry loans. The emerging nations were discovered as emerging markets for this new international financial capital. Hundreds of billions of dollars in loan money were generated in this way. Before 1973, third world debt was manageable and contained. It was financed mainly through public agencies, including the World Bank, which invested in projects promising solid economic success. But things changed when private commercial banks got into the game. The banks were not in the business of development. They were in the business of loan brokering, Some called it loan sharking. The banks preferred stable governments for clients. Generally, that meant governments controlled by dictators. How these dictators had come to power and what they did with the money were not of immediate concern to the banks. The Philippines, Chile, Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay were all prime loan targets. In many cases, the dictators used the money for their own ends without significantly bettering the condition of the people, but the people were saddled with the bill. The screws were tightened in 1979 when the U.S. Federal Reserve, under Chairman Paul Volcker, unilaterally hiked interest rates to crippling levels. Engdahl notes that this was done after foreign dollar holders began dumping their dollars in protest over the foreign policies of the Carter administration. Within weeks, Volcker allowed U.S. interest rates to triple. They rose to over 20%, forcing global interest rates through the roof, triggering a global recession and mass unemployment. By 1982, the dollar's status as global reserve currency had been saved, but the entire third world was on the brink of bankruptcy, choking from usurious interest changes on their petrodollar loans. That was when the IMF got in the game, brought in by the London and New York banks to enforce debt repayment and act as a debt policeman. Public spending for health, education, and welfare in debtor countries was slashed, following IMF orders to ensure that the banks got timely debt service on their petrodollars. The banks also brought pressure on the U.S. government to bail them out from the consequences of their imprudent loans, using taxpayer money and U.S. assets to do it. The results were austerity measures for third world countries and taxation for American workers to provide welfare for the banks. The banks were emboldened to keep aggressively lending, confident that they would again be bailed out if the debtors' loans went into default. Worse for American citizens, the United States itself ended up a major debtor nation. Because oil is an essential commodity for every country, the petrodollar system requires other countries to build up huge trade surpluses in order to accumulate the dollar surpluses they need to buy oil. These countries have to sell more goods in dollars than they buy to give them a positive dollar balance. That is true for every country except the United States, which controls the dollar and issues it at will. More accurately, the Federal Reserve and the private commercial banking system it represents control the dollar and issue it at will. Since U.S. economic dominance depends on the dollar recycling process, the United States has acquiesced in becoming importer of last resort. The result has been to saddle it with a growing negative trade balance or current account deficit. By 2000, U.S. trade deficits and net liabilities to foreign accounts were well over 22% of gross domestic product. In 2001, the U.S. stock market collapsed, and tax cuts and increased federal spending turned the federal budget surplus into massive budget deficits. In the 3 years after 2000, the net U.S. debt position almost doubled. The United States had to bring in $1.4 billion in foreign capital daily just to fund the debt and keep the dollar recycling game going. By 2006, the figure was up to $2.5 billion daily. The people of the United States, like those of the Third World, have become hopelessly mired in debt to support the banking system of a private international cartel. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, the next step will be to look at the tequila trap, which is the real story behind the illegal alien invasion. And again, paralleling to the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and the search for the Wicked Witch. In the book, it says, the witch bade her clean the pots and kettles and sweep the floor and keep the fire fed with wood. Dorothy went to work meekly, with her mind made up to work as hard as she could, for she was glad the Wicked Witch had decided not to kill her. Waves of immigrants are now pouring over the Mexican border into the United States in search of work, precipitating an illegal alien crisis for Americans. Vigilante border patrols view these immigrants as potential terrorists, but in fact, they are refugees from an economic war that has deprived them of their own property and forced them into debt bondage to a private global banking cartel. When Mexico was conquered in 1520, the mighty Aztec Empire was ruled by the unsuspecting, hospitable Montezuma. The Spanish General Cortes, propelled by the lure of gold, conquered by warfare, violence, and genocide. When Mexico fell again in the 20th century, it was to a more covert form of aggression, one involving a drastic devaluation of the national currency. If Montezuma's curse was his copious store of gold, for Mexico in the 20th century, it was the country's copious store of oil. William Engdahl tells the story in his revealing political history, A Century of War. He notes that the first Mexican national constitution vested the government with direct ownership of all minerals, petroleum, and hydrocarbons in 1917. But when the British and American oil interests persisted in an intense behind-the-scenes battle for these oil reserves, the Mexican government finally nationalized all its foreign oil holdings. The move led the British and American oil majors to boycott Mexico for the next 40 years. When new oil reserves were discovered in Mexico in the 1970s, President José López Portillo undertook an impressive modernization and industrialization program, and Mexico became the most rapidly growing economy in the developing world. But the prospect of a strong industrial Mexico on the southern border of the United States was intolerable to certain powerful Anglo-American interests who determined to sabotage Mexico's industrialization by securing rigid repayment of its foreign debt. That was when interest rates were tripled. Third world loans were particularly vulnerable to this manipulation because they were usually subject to floating or variable interest rates. The question comes up, why did Mexico need to go into debt to foreign lenders? It had its own oil in abundance. It had accepted development loans earlier, but it had largely paid them off. The problem for Mexico was that it was one of those intrepid countries that had declined to let its national currency float. Mexican dollar reserves were exhausted by speculative raids in the 1980s, forcing it to borrow just to defend the value of the peso. According to Henry Liu, writing in the Asian Times, Mexico's mistake was in keeping its currency freely convertible into dollars, requiring it to keep enough dollar reserves to buy back the pesos of anyone wanting to sell. When those reserves ran out, it had to borrow dollars on the international market just to maintain its currency peg. In 1982, President Portillo warned of hidden foreign interests that were trying to destabilize Mexico through panic rumors, causing capital flight out of the country. Speculators were cashing in their pesos for dollars and depleting the government's dollar reserves in anticipation that the peso would have to be devalued. In an attempt to stem the capital flight, the government cracked under the pressure and did devalue the peso, but while the currency immediately lost 30% of its value, the devastating wave of speculation continued. Mexico was characterized as a high-risk country, leading international lenders to decline to roll over their loans. Caught by peso devaluation, capital flight, and lender refusal to roll over its debt, the country faced economic chaos. At the General Assembly of the United Nations, President Portillo called on the nations of the world to prevent a regression into the dark ages precipitated by the unbearably high interest rates of the global bankers. In an attempt to stabilize the situation, the president took the bold move of taking charge of the banks. The Bank of Mexico and the country's private banks were taken over by the government, with compensation to their private owners. It was the sort of move calculated to set off alarm bells for the international banking cartel. A global movement to nationalize the banks could destroy their whole economic empire. They wanted the banks privatized and under their control. The U.S. Secretary of State was then George Shultz, a major player in the 1971 unpegging of the dollar from gold. He responded with a plan to save the Wall Street banking empire by having the IMF act as debt policemen. Henry Kissinger's consultancy firm was called in to design the program. The result, says Engdahl, was the most concerted, organized looting operation in modern history, carrying the most onerous debt collection terms since the Versailles reparations process of the early 1920s. The debt repayment plan blamed for propelling Germany into World War II. Mexico's state-owned banks were returned to private ownership, but they were sold strictly to domestic Mexican purchasers. Not until the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, was foreign competition ever partially allowed. Signed by Canada, Mexico, and the United States, NAFTA established a free trade zone in North America to take effect on January 1, 1994. In entering the agreement, Carlos Salinas, the outgoing Mexican president, broke with decades of Mexican policy of high tariffs to protect state-owned industry from competition by U.S. corporations. By 1994, Mexico had restored its standing with investors. It had a balanced budget, a growth rate of over 3%, and a stock market that was up fivefold. In February 1995, Jane Ingraham wrote in The New American that Mexico's fiscal policy was in some respects superior and saner than our own wildly spendthrift Washington circus. Mexico received enormous amounts of foreign investment after being singled out as the most promising and safest of Latin American markets. Investors were therefore shocked and surprised when a newly elected president, Ernesto Zedillo, suddenly announced a 13% devaluation of the peso, since there seemed no valid reason for the move. The following day, Zedillo allowed the formerly managed peso to float freely against the dollar. The peso immediately plunged by 39%. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, what was going on with all of this? In 1994, the U.S. Congressional Budget Office report on NAFTA had diagnosed the peso as overvalued by 20%. The Mexican government was advised to unpeg the currency and let it float, allowing it to fall naturally to its true level. The theory was that it would fall by only 20%, but that is not what happened. Speculators pushed the peso down sharply and abruptly, collapsing its value. The collapse was blamed on the lack of investor confidence due to Mexico's negative trade balance, but as Ingraham observes, investor confidence was quite high immediately before the collapse. If a negative trade balance is what sends a currency into massive devaluation and hyperinflation, the U.S. dollar itself should have been driven there long ago. By 2001, U.S. public and private debt totaled 10 times the debt of all third world countries combined. Although the peso's collapse was supposedly unanticipated, over $4 billion U.S. dollars suddenly and mysteriously left Mexico in the 20 days before it occurred. 6 months later, this money had twice the Mexican purchasing power it had earlier. Later, commentators maintained that lead investors with inside information precipitated the stampede out of the peso. The suspicion was that these investors were the same parties who profited from the Mexican bailout that followed. When Mexico's banks ran out of dollars to pay off its creditors, which were largely U.S. banks, the U.S. government stepped in with U.S. tax dollars. The Mexican bailout was engineered by Robert Rubin, who headed the investment bank Goldman Sachs before he became U.S. Treasury Secretary. Goldman Sachs was then heavily invested in short-term dollar-denominated Mexican bonds. The bailout was arranged the day of Rubin's appointment. The money provided by U.S. taxpayers did not go to Mexico, but went straight into the vaults of Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and other big American lenders whose risky loans were on the line. The late Jude Winiski was a conservative economist who was at one time a Wall Street Journal editor and advisor to President Reagan. He cynically observed of this banker coup, quote, "There was a big party at Morgan Stanley after the Mexican peso devaluation. People from all over Wall Street came. They drank champagne and smoked cigars and congratulated themselves on how they pulled it off and they made a fortune. These people are pirates, international pirates." End quote. The loot was more than just profits of gamblers who had bet the right way. The pirates actually got control of Mexico's banks. NAFTA rules had already opened the nationalized Mexican banking system to a number of U.S. banks, with Mexican licenses being granted to 18 big foreign banks and 16 brokers, including Goldman Sachs. But these banks could bring in no more than 20% of the system's total capital, limiting their market share in loans and securities holdings. By 2004, this limitation had been removed. All but one of Mexico's major banks had been sold to foreign banks, which gained total access to the formerly closed Mexican banking market. The value of Mexican pesos and Mexican stocks collapsed altogether, supposedly because there was a stampede to sell and no one around to buy. But buyers with ample funds were sitting on the sidelines, waiting to pick over the devalued stock at bargain basement prices. The result was a direct transfer of wealth from the local economy to international money manipulators. The devaluation also precipitated a wave of privatizations, sales of public assets to private corporations, as the Mexican government tried to meet its spiraling debt crisis. In a February 1996 article called Militant Capitalism, David Peterson blamed the rout on an assault on the peso by short sellers. He wrote, quote, "The austerity measures that the U.S. government and the IMF forced on Mexicans in the aftermath of last winter's assault on the peso by short sellers in the foreign exchange markets have been something to behold. Almost overnight, the Mexican people have had to endure dramatic cuts in government spending, a sharp hike in regressive sales tax, at least 1 million layoffs, a conservative estimate, a spike in interest rates so pronounced as to render their debts unserviceable, hence El Brazón, a nationwide movement of small debtors to resist property seizures and to seek a rescheduling of their debts, a collapse in consumer spending on the order of 25% by mid-year, and, in brief, a 10.5% contraction in overall economic activity during the second quarter, with more of the same sure to follow," end quote. By 1995, Mexico's foreign debt was more than twice the country's total debt payment for the previous century and a half. Per capita income had fallen by almost a third from a earlier year, and the Mexican purchasing power had fallen by well over 50%. Mexico was propelled into a crippling national depression that lasted for over a decade. As in the U.S. Depression of the 1930s, the actual value of Mexican businesses and assets did not change during this speculator-induced crisis. What changed was simply that currency had been sucked out of the economy by investors stampeding to get out of the Mexican stock market, leaving insufficient money in circulation to pay workers, buy raw materials, finance loans, and operate the country. It was further evidence that when short selling is allowed, currencies are driven into hyperinflation, not by the market mechanisms of supply and demand, but by the concerted action of currency speculators. The flip side of this also appears to be true. The U.S. dollar remains strong despite its plunging trade balance because it has been artificially manipulated up by the Fed. And we'll talk more about this in the future. Market manipulators, not free market forces, are in control. Countries around the world have been caught in the same trap that captured Mexico. Henry C.K. Liu calls it the tequila trap. He also calls it a suicidal policy masked by the giddy expansion typical of the early phase of a Ponzi scheme. The lure in the trap is the promise of massive dollar investment. At first, returns are spectacular, but as with every Ponzi scheme, the returns eventually collapse, leaving the people massively in debt to foreign bankers who will become their new economic masters. The former Soviet states, the tiger economies of Southeast Asia, and the Latin American banana republics all succumbed to these rapacious tactics. Local ineptitude and corrupt politicians are blamed when the real culprits are international banking speculators armed with tsunami-sized walls of credit created on computer screens. Targeted countries are advised that to attract foreign investment, they must make their currencies freely convertible into dollars at prevailing or floating exchange rates, and they must keep adequate dollars in reserve for anyone who wants to change from one currency to another. After the trap is set, the speculators move in. Speculation has been known to bring down currencies and national economies in a single day. Michael Chasudovsky, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, writes, quote, "The media tends to identify these currency crises as being the product of some internal mechanism, internal political weakness or corruption. The linkages to international finances are downplayed. The fact of the matter is that currency speculation using speculative instruments was ultimately the means whereby the central bank reserves were literally confiscated by private speculators." End quote. While economists debate the fiscal pros and cons of floating exchange rates, from a legal standpoint, they represent a blatant fraud on the people who depend on a stable medium of exchange. They are as much a fraud as a grocer's scales with rocks on it. If a farmer's peso was worth 30 cents yesterday and is worth only 5 cents today, his dozen eggs have suddenly shrunk to 2 eggs, his dozen apples to 2 apples. The very notion that a country has to defend its currency shows that there is something wrong with the system. Inches don't have to defend themselves against millimeters, but peacefully coexist with them side by side on the same yardstick. A sovereign government has both the right and the duty to calibrate its medium of exchange so that it is a stable measurement of purchasing power for its people. And in the future, we'll look at how a stable international currency yardstick might be devised. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.